Welcome to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Betsy Fentress.
And I'm Ashley McGuire.
And what a thrill today to welcome a friend to the show, John O'Leary, who has a story well known in St. Louis, but also to countless people and Catholics across the country. His harrowing ordeal, Surviving a Fire, is now finally coming to the silver screen. Soul on Fire, starring John Corbett and William H. Macy, comes to theaters October 10th with a premiere in St. Louis this coming week. And John, we're so happy to have you join us today so we can hear your story and share it with those who don't know it.
Betsy, so it's nice to be interviewed by a friend and have the person sincerely mean it. And not only that, but you and I are practically neighbors. So I did not know that connection until we went live, but I'm grateful to be on the show.
Your story has been shared across the world. You have become a famous speaker. You take your piano with you and do all kinds of things that people don't expect out of you. But can you tell us your own account of that fateful day when you were only 9 years old and you decided to copy some boys you saw in the neighborhood, literally playing with fire? What made you decide to go back home and try that trick?
People underrate that monkey see, monkey do is a reality, not just in nature, but in life. So we become like the people we hang out with. It's why what you listen to, what you read, who you hang out with is so influential in your life. So if you're listening to today and you're listening to this station, you're listening wisely, truly. So I'm grateful for that. But I my eyes pointed in the wrong direction. I'm following 12, 13-year-old boys, and I figure if they could do it, so could I. So on a Saturday morning, January 17th, 1987, a lifetime ago, I walked into my mom and dad's garage here in St. Louis, Missouri. I bent over a 5-gallon can of gasoline, lit a piece of cardboard on fire, tried to pour a little bit of gasoline on top, and before the liquid even came out, the fumes, you could almost hear that sucking sound, like pulled it back in, created this massive explosion, split the metal in two, picked up the 9-year-old boy, and it launched me 20 feet against the far side of the garage. And a very difficult, very long, hard morning made far shorter, I found myself about an hour later on my back in a hospital with burns on 100% of my body. 87% of those burns are third degree, and I'm dying.
That's just an incredible story. So brought to life so well by the screener that Ashley and I got to watch last night.
John, one of the things that really stood out to me in the film is the way it brings to life all of the different ways that different people not just saved your life, but really brought new meaning and purpose to your life. You know, the first thing was just, and this really comes out at the end, your siblings. Tell us a little bit about the different roles your own siblings and your father and your mother played, both in those, you know, critical moments when your life was on the line and then further down the road.
Awesome. I'm going to begin with my siblings with the end in mind. So my siblings on Thursday this week will be in the front row of the VIP level in the middle. This is where like the actors should be and the director. And yet when we assigned the VIPs, I wanted them to get the front row. And you're like, well, why? They are for me today. They celebrate every success that I've ever had, and they mourn every failure and tragedy that we're part of today. They're so for me. And why that's so remarkable is twofold, I think. Number one is half of adults don't have a relationship with their sibling. Mm. And all six of O'Leary's are absolutely in love with one another. That's what a blessing. The other aspect, though, is when I was a kid and burned, it was their house that I burned down. It was their mom and dad that I stole from them for 5.5 months. Like, mom and dad weren't with them. They were only with me. Even when John came home from the hospital, we celebrated the hero in the wheelchair. Look at little John. Isn't he tough? And they were ignored. For years afterwards, surgeries and therapy, the light is bright on John. And then he does a book and he becomes a speaker. And now there's a movie. And at every single step along the way, these little kids and these older versions of those little kids celebrate John. So it is such a credit to their character. And I think to the way they were raised by my mom and dad that they are who they are. So I'm wild about them and I'm grateful for them. And you asked about what they did the day I was burned. Well, when I was coming out of the garage on fire, I didn't know what to do other than run. So I ran back into my mom and dad's house. I stood on top of a rug and 9 years old, flames leaping 3 feet off of me in all directions. And my brother Jim sees what has happened, has no idea what caused it, doesn't care. Instead, he goes to work. He picks up a rug. He beats down the flames, burns himself in the process, carries me outside, throws me on the grass, rolls around on top of me, goes back into the house, chases my siblings, all the girls out of the house, calls 911, and then brings the dog out. So 1987, the lifesaver of the year for the state of Missouri was not a first responder or a veteran, but a teenager, a kid named Jim O'Leary, who changed. I think that's remarkable. Like as a kid, he changed. And then over, you asked about the siblings, plural. Well, there are two others that are home that day. My sister Amy, who's 11 and always was a bit of a caregiver. We are chased outside through the smoke and the heat. It's snowing in St. Louis. It's actually January 17th. It's snowing. It's frigid. If I was Amy, I would have run to a neighbor's house for shelter and safety. This girl came over to me and she just held me in the front yard. And she kept saying to me, John, everything's okay. Have faith and fight. The best is yet to come. And to her encouragement, I responded, it's not okay. Amy, look at me. I'm naked. My clothes have been burnt off my skin. Like, it's not okay. The house is burning. I did that. And so I remember saying to her, like, Amy, it's not fine this time. Go into the house, get me a knife and just kill me. Like, I can't take this. And this little 11-year-old pulls me even closer and says, don't say that. It's okay. Have faith and fight. The best is yet to come.
So we're talking about the movie Soul on Fire, which will premiere next week. And John, tell us about some of the other people that were in the movie. Are you still in contact with them? Because everybody from a Girl Scout leader to a really famous Cardinal baseball broadcaster, Jack Buck, appears in this movie. And the people who are in the maintenance staff at the hospital play an important role too.
So the very cool thing is part of the reason why we had to have the premiere in St. Louis is to invite our friends. And part of the reason why we needed a 2,300 person theater is because we have a lot of them. And that doesn't mean we're popular. It just means we've been well served. So at that premiere will be a nurse who helped save my life. You might remember him as Roy. You'll remember th there was a team of folks around him, all these folks from custodial staff to PTs and OTs, speech therapists, nurses, CNAs, chaplains. We've invited them. There was a doctor. His name, if you saw the screener, his name is Vachia Vajin. Dr. Vajin's 91.
Wow.
He lives in Cincinnati and he's coming in tomorrow with his daughter to go to the premiere. So th these profoundly important grace bearers in my life as a kid, still do this as an adult. I'm so grateful. So many of them, by the way, were background talent in the film. So then the hospital scenes, the nurses who look like they might have a little bit more experience on the floor, well, they do because in 1987, they were my nurse. So that's pretty cool. You mentioned Jack Buck, the radio announcer. He passed away in 2002, but his widow will be there. His sibling, his daughter's son will be there. His daughter, his granddaughters will be there. And so the Buck family will be representing. In other words, the folks who fought for this little boy who had no earthly chance of surviving, I credit my mom and dad with this. They recognized the graces that they'd received and they held on to these people close. And we can't wait to celebrate those people on October 2nd at the premiere.
So I'm a baseball mom. I have two boys who play very competitive baseball, and my husband's a huge lifelong baseball fan. And I was starting your screener when he walked in. He goes, "Hey, that's Busch Stadium. What are you watching?" And he's like, "That's Jack Buck." And then he was like, "What is this?" And he ended up sitting down and watching the whole movie with me. But it added just such a to tell us a little bit about the role that baseball has played in your life, not just the, it really seems like Jack Buck helped pull you through in those critical moments, but But that, do you still have John O'Leary Day, and are you really throwing strikes? And tell us more about baseball in life.
Well, I believe in a God of miracles, and there was a John O'Leary Day at the ballpark 30 years to the day afterwards of the original. And I spoke to the Cardinals, the baseball team, and then afterwards went out and dude, I mean, I don't have fingers, right? They've been amputated, so this is a balancing act. And only through grace, I did throw a strike that one time. I'm not sure I could repeat it if you gave me 100 more chances. So let's just hang up the O'Leary jersey and retire officially. So that's what's happening today. But like you, Ashley, I'm raising kids. I have three who are into baseball, and spent a lot of time burning in the sun outside, watching paint dry. So I know what it's like to be watching youth baseball Saturday and Sunday for hours at a time. The reason, though, I got into it was as a kid, man, I just loved listening to baseball. That's generally what we did as kids back in the 80s. And the voice we heard was Jack Buck. He was a bigger than life voice for those of us in the Midwest, huge, huge for Cardinal Nation. Then I get burned on a Saturday that evening as I'm laying in a hospital bed dying. My hero, Jack Buck, walks into the room. It's a true story. Sits down next to me and says, "Kid, wake up. Wake up. You are going to live. Keep fighting. John O'Leary Day at the ballpark will make it all worthwhile. Keep fighting." And even though he was told by the staff I would die afterwards, he came back the following day. In the following day. And so that this man, this humble servant, was a person of action and service and love and generosity. And the wild thing about Jack Buck, many things are wild, but he never told anybody what he was doing. It's not in books, it's not in highlight reels, it's not him celebrating his greatness. Jack emptied himself into others because he knew his life could make a difference. And part of the objective of the film is to remind all of us, whether you are a radio announcer on top of the world, or you are a custodial staff member making minimum wage, or you're a 7-year-old girl and you don't always like your older brother, or you're a busy parent, or you're a college roommate, or you're a fill in the blank, that your life has the ability to influence someone else's life in mighty ways. Don't cheapen that.
John, you're using a lot of religious language. You're using the language of faith and you're talking about grace. Can you share about your Catholic faith and where it was as a 9-year-old, where it was when you were the party animal at St. Louis University, and where you are today? What has that journey been like?
Yeah. So 9-year-old kid, I went to a parish called St. Clements of Rome. Awesome. For the Friday before I was burned, I painted a picture of Jesus walking on water, and he was calling Peter out. And I remember that in the painting or coloring, whatever it was, Peter's partially walking, partially sinking, and there are 11 boys in the boat cowering, waiting for Jesus to get back in the boat with them. And as I colored that, I remember thinking, if I'm ever called out of the boat, I'm going. Like, I can't believe these 11 guys who knew Jesus are hiding, which is important because the day I was burned, my mom walked into the emergency room. And this is all just a true story. She took my right hand, she patted my bald head, and she said, "Baby, I love you." And I said, "Mom, will you knock it off with the love? Am I going to die? Is this fire going to kill me?" And her response was really not one of hope, or she did not cuddle me. Instead, she spoke truth. She said, "Baby, do you want to? It's your choice. It's not mine." And I responded, "Mama, I don't want to die. I want to live. I want to live." And her response was good. "Then take the hand of God, walk the journey with him, and fight like you never fought before." She said, "Daddy and I will be with you, man. We're not going anywhere, but do your part. Take his hand and fight." And on the heels of coloring, Peter halfway walking on the water, I knew, okay, it's time to get out of the boat. It's time to walk. So that faith background prepared me for that moment. It really did. You asked about it in college. What I've noticed in my faith walking, maybe you are different, and maybe your listeners are different. It ebbs and flows, though, in particular when I'm not intentional on it. So I have been a person of faith my entire life, but I haven't always been on fire in my faith. And even in college, even in the party scene, even when I did not believe in who I was, I still would stumble into church on Sunday nights at 10. I went to St. Louis University, and that's when we had it. And the cool thing about SLU is it was packed. And I'd marry a girl that I saw in that church. And a lot of my fraternity brothers would stumble into that church. And there's something about doing community in community, even when you're not exactly sure what you're doing yet. I believe in grace. When my friend Mark Haberberger passed away in a single car accident in college, I struggled with my faith. When another friend of mine named Mike Reakey passed away in a single car accident, I struggled in my faith. When life wasn't going the way I wanted it to relationally with Beth, I struggled in my faith. When my dad got Parkinson's disease, I struggled in my, like, I struggle. And yet we love a God who's big enough to wrestle back with us gently and doesn't let go. And so you ask where am I today? Man, I'm in the Word every day. I'm in the sacraments. I believe in the power of the Word and the sacraments and Jesus to change our lives for good, even when we don't deserve it. And I'm not being humble here. I don't deserve it. I'm broken. I'm sinful. I've made a ton of mistakes. Many, many, many. Some showed up in the movie, some can't. I make mistakes all the time. And yet we have a God. Every time I make my way toward the Eucharist, we have a dead person on a cross in front of us. Like, what faith would celebrate that? The Catholic faith. Because through that suffering, through that sacrifice, through that passion, comes death. Yeah, that's part of the story, but that's not the end of the story. This is not how it ends. Keep walking forward. Keep learning more. There's promise of salvation. Sunday comes. And so there are days, my friends, where like I hang out in Friday. You know, I feel like I'm living Friday. But our faith informs us that Sunday's coming. You just got to keep stepping forward.
That's really beautiful, John.
You mentioned your mother, and in the movie, your mother is portrayed as being a little bit tough on you almost when you come home from the hospital and making you learn right off the bat to eat with silverware and actually having you go back to piano lessons. I love that line in the movie, and I'm curious to know if that's what she really said. You know, she said, "In my house, my children take piano." Like, you know, you weren't, she wasn't going to coddle you. How accurate is that? And tell us a little bit about the fact that you still play piano for crowds.
Whew, man. So my mom and my dad recently passed away of Parkinson's disease, and he did so after a 30-year fight. And now he's at peace and perfectly in heaven. And I'm in peace with this. It's only been a couple months, and I feel closer to my dad than I felt when he was alive. Like, it's just surreal. It's such a gift. He died at home though, because his wife fought for that to happen for decades. She just n nursed him, guided him, tough loved him to the finish line. So what you saw in the film is who my mom is. And in candor, they undersold her. She is way tougher than the woman they put up there in the film. There are even some scenes like when John learns how to eat in the movie, they actually shortened that by about 80% because it was awkward. And early viewers were like, no mom would do that. Well, my mom did. And because of that, I eat today. I changed diapers today. I got dressed by myself today. I'm very capable today because I've had a mother who said to me, you can do hard things. You can do hard things. One of the examples of this was the piano. All six O'Learys took the piano. Mine was Wednesday afternoons. So when I was well enough, and I don't mean like well, I was barely out of the hospital. This teacher starts showing up at my house. Would put a pen in the early days because I was still wrapped in bandages in the earliest of days, put a pen on my fingerless, broken hand. In other words, if you go back to the faith question you asked a moment ago, like the very thing that defined how ugly the world is, this cross with suffering all over it, the very thing that we see only as broken, once redefined and once redeemed, becomes the thing that makes it like remarkable and incredible and life-changing. So the very thing about my life I hated most back then, my hands, was the thing the teacher used. Like, whew. So she puts a pen on top of it, and now a little boy learns with a pen how to play the piano. And then they did a couple surgeries so I could push one key at a time, and then two, and then like little baby chords. And I never, never, ever, ever played the piano in public because I pushed the wrong keys. And then I was at a conference at the MGM Grand in Las Vegas. And the woman in charge had read that John O'Leary plays the piano And I'm like, I do, man, but that's only at home. And she said, will you play for my family today? And her family was 27,000. And I learned a long time ago, the answer is yes. Like, just shut your eyes and walk. So I said, yes, ma'am. I said, what song would you like to hear? And she said, what's your mom's favorite? I said, well, my mom's favorite's Amazing Grace. She goes, go ahead and play that. So in the secular room, it's a sales conference with people gathered from around the world. This fingerless, introverted, awkward guy who still stumbles and struggles in the bright light, at the end of the speech, sits down at a piano bench and plays his mother's favorite song, which is wild. Like, it's so grace-filled. What makes it even more wild is after that song, everyone stands up, it's a standing ovation for that song, for the piano teacher, for the mom. There's a book signing. And in the book signing, a woman named Linda comes up and says, John, that song and this story have moved me so much. Have you ever thought about turning it into a film? And I said, no. So she says, could I try? And so this entire film project, which brings us together on your show today, is because I had a chance to speak at a conference in Vegas, play the piano because my mom taught me. This woman was moved by it. Had no idea how she was going to struggle this thing together, but she did. Asked the question, can I do this? And I said, you could try. Go, you can try. And over the last 9 years, that's what Linda has been trying to turn this story of brokenness into redemption.
Well, John, we hope that all of our listeners will go and watch Soul on Fire after it's released and to read your two books, On Fire, The Seven Choices to Ignite a Radically Inspired Life, and In Awe, Rediscover Your Childlike Wonder to Unleash Inspiration, Meaning, and Joy. Thank you so much for joining us. And to learn more about John O'Leary, go to johnoleary.inspires.com and make sure to check out his new film, Soul on Fire. And to learn more about us, go to CatholicAssociation.org. John, it's been a privilege to have you on our show.
My neighbor and friend, great to be with you. Ashley, also a pleasure to meet you.
Thanks, John.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, where I am once again joined by our esteemed chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry. And this week, with the beginning of October, we've got all kinds of wonderful things coming up. Can we talk about Saint Therese as the co-patroness of the missions and her upcoming feast day and how she fits in to World Mission Month?
Well, her feast day is October 1st, the beginning of the month. We start with her, so it was Wednesday. And Saint Therese is one of the most beloved saints. She was by far the most popular saint after Our Lady in the entire 20th century. And so many of us have a great devotion to her. We know her for her little way of trust and love, which makes holiness simple and straightforward for many of us. So many of us, myself included, have received great miracles from her because she prophesied before she was dying at the age of 24 in 1897 that she would spend her heaven doing good upon earth, that her prayers would be powerful, and that she would somehow let us know through the shearing of roses, because she was a little flower and never thought she could be a big flower, big, beautiful, and impressive like a rose. But that's normally the way that she communicates. And so many of us have received really special favors through her prayers. But one of the things that complexes people sometimes is when we refer to this Carmelite cloistered nun who, from the time of 15 and a half to 24, never left her cloister in northwestern France. Why would we possibly call her the co-patroness of the missions?
I was
Together
going to
with
ask you that.
together with Saint Francis Xavier, the great missionary who evangelized three whole countries and then died on the shores of China, ready to bring the gospel to a fourth. It makes sense why he's the patron of the missions, but why this humble little French nun? And the ultimate reason for it is because the mission of the church always begins in prayer. Jesus told us, pray to the harvest master for laborers for his harvest. And he said, and Therese loved this saying, look up and see that the fields are ripe for the harvest. And she interpreted that as lift up your hearts, lift up your head, look toward God and see that the fields are ripe, and then really pray to the harvest master. What's moved me about Saint Therese is she had the heart of a missionary, and she is a patroness of the church's prayer for the mission. She adopted two Seminarians and young priests who were missionaries in Africa. One, Father Maurice Bellier, who was a white father, or the African mission fathers. The other was Father Alphonse Roulant, who was a the MEP fathers, the Missionnaire Étranger Pontifique, I think, the Pontifical Foreign Missions. But one of them asked her, how is it even possible that now, 1800 years after Jesus died, writing in the late 1800s, that so many people have never even heard of Jesus Christ? And Saint Therese responded, because of the complacency and the laziness of most of us.
Right.
When we look at the whole world today, we see that out of the 8 billion, 8.1 billion alive, 5.5 billion don't know Jesus. And out of that 5.5 billion, 80% have never even really heard of him. And many of us start to say, well, I'm s upset that I have lost this mass at my local parish, and now I have to travel 5 miles down the road, or things like this, what we call first world issues, where 5.5 out of 8.1 billion people don't know Jesus Christ. And so we really have to be praying as if lives depend on it, because they do, eternal lives dependent on it. And Saint Therese is the one who shows us how to do that. She had wanted to become a missionary nun, starting a Carmel in Vietnam. She was too sick in order to be able to go, but her heart was always there, because she wanted to bring Christ to the extent of the world. And she's praying for all of us, trying to send down roses so that we will live out much more concertedly the missionary dimension of our baptism.
Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Betsy Fentress, and we are thrilled to have back with us once again Claire Morrell, the woman behind the Technology and Human Flourishing Project at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Claire has worked at the Department of Justice as well as the White House Counsel's Office, and her new book is still making waves after its summer release. It's called The Tech Exit, A Practical Guide to Freeing Kids and Teens from Smartphones. Claire, you've been so busy promoting your book all summer. Thanks so much for taking time to join us today as the school year begins.
Oh, absolutely. Happy to be here.
So you've referred to kids who get addicted to smartphones. It's a digital fentanyl. And that phrase seems on social media, at least, to really have resonated with a lot of people who need that stark reminder of how this is really harming kids. So let's talk about what has happened with the family as a result of a whole generation of children with computers in their pockets.
Yes, I mean, there's so much to unpack there. But the reason I try to make that analogy is because I think sometimes we've just gotten the metaphor wrong as a culture and approached smartphones and these interactive screens like sugar, something that we don't want to give our kids too much of, but that we can enjoy in some moderation. And what I'm trying to convey to parents is the same way that a very highly potent drug is not safe, even in a small amount, is also true of the screens, because they have an incredibly addictive design. And so it's not a neutral technology that you could use for good or use for bad, that the underlying design is bent towards addiction. They want to addict our kids. And so even a small amount of time creates this constant craving for more. And so what we see in the family then is kids are just drawn into these devices. They become immersed in the online environment. It starts to feel more like real life for them. This online world is more of their reality than the real world that they're in. And so we see the distancing among family members, really severing those family relationships because they're so consumed and absorbed by the device that continually draws them in. And the last thing I will say on that is, with screen time limits, the problem is that the screen time limit doesn't map onto a child's mental or emotional time spent in the app. And so you may say, well, we only let her spend 15 minutes a day on Instagram. But then you notice these changes in her behavior. She's withdrawn from the family. She's not interested in real life things anymore. It's because her thought life, her emotional, her spiritual life is now dominated by obsessive thoughts and worry that can linger hours after leaving the app, just wondering, who liked her post? What are other people saying? Because the metrics of social media are so driven to create this constant comparison, and to constantly draw us back to the apps. And so, it's really having a very unfortunate impact on family life and family relationships.
Jonathan Haidt has a post just today about a video. He's at a conference in Australia. Of course, he wrote The Anxious Generation, which really brought this epidemic really to the fore.
That's right.
And there's a very upsetting and moving clip of a woman whose daughter died by suicide, and she completely blames it on social media. And so we're seeing, Claire, and I know that you've been involved in policy in the past. We're seeing schools and states start adopting laws around this issue. Is it really gaining traction from a policy perspective?
Yes, I think just in the last several years, we've just seen laws being passed, school policies being changed. I mean, 18 states, plus now the District of Columbia, all have bell-to-bell phone bans statewide. And that wasn't the case just several years ago. I mean, there were some school districts doing this who were early leaders, but now states, entire states are going bell to bell, no phones at school because these policies are having just tremendous success. The schools and school districts that implemented them were seeing such positive results that now this is spreading nationwide. And so we're seeing more states getting on board. And then we're also seeing states pass laws around age restricting pornography websites. 24 states just in the last 3 years have passed those laws, and the Supreme Court in June upheld it as constitutional, paving the way for more states to follow suit. So that's 24 states, almost half the country. And then now several states have passed social media laws requiring age verification or parental consent to create a social media account, that a parent should be part of that process. And then even more recently, three states have now passed a bill called the App Store Accountability Act, which would hold app stores accountable for obtaining parental consent for a minor to access the app store or for any app download. Because the problem isn't just social media, it's kids are now accessing these new AI apps. There are new ones every day. It's impossible to effectively lock down a smartphone, which is why I encourage parents to opt out entirely. But even for those parents who may not choose that path, we want all kids to be more protected, for parents to be more involved. And these policy solutions are really trying to restore that rightful parental authority, to make sure parents are the ones deciding what apps get onto a kid's phone, whether or not they get on social media. So yes, this is a growing trend in policy, and I'm encouraged, by the progress that's just been made in the last few years.
We're going to talk about a pretty upsetting new app that some girls are really falling prey to. But before we do that, I want to ask you, are parents a part of the problem because so many of them are addicted to their phones? And how do you address that in your book?
Yes, no, parents, we can be part of the problem, and we can also be part of the solution, because the main way that our children will learn how to use technology wisely as adults isn't by handing a child a device that they're not mature enough to handle too young, but it's by parents modeling for our kids what kind of use of technology they should have as an adult. And the problem is, when we are drawn into our own phones, we're communicating to that child that this is what adults do. That this is what we value, that phones are more valuable than real life relationships and interactions. And so, if we are trying to delay our kids having smartphones, we really have to examine our own smartphone practices, to not be hypocritical if we're telling our kids these are the reasons we're not giving this to you, and that we fall into that addictive design ourselves. And because we want to be training and modeling for them how to use it appropriately as a tool, but not something that is distracting you away from real life. So, I encourage parents in my book, I have a whole chapter kind of focused on what parents should do for their own tech use, to just distance ourselves physically from our smartphones, especially when we're home, when we're with our kids. Put the phone in another room or in a box, turn off your notifications, and then consider ways to just make your phone less addicting to you. Take off apps that you don't need, turn off notifications, make it truly a tool you use intentionally, not something that then sucks your time away from the real world.
Have you heard of something called bricking your phone? Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I have heard that that has been successful for some adults. They've used that to just really completely lock themselves out so that they because I mean, we all can fall prey in a moment of weakness giving into something. So there are practices you can set up in your own life to make it more difficult for you to use your phone. I think that's great.
Yeah, it's in a device, I think, that you have to go take your phone and put it next to it. But I know somebody that's been pretty successful with
Good.
using that. So let's talk about this, how AI is an even bigger problem in this whole social media sphere, and that there's an app where girls are uploading photos of themselves and they're getting rated.
Yes. Yes, I've been looking into this more recently. So that's what I was kind of trying to say, that there are new apps every day in the app store that you would just have no idea as a parent. And so these new AI beauty apps, girls are uploading photos, and then the AI of the app analyzes the photo for certain features like facial symmetry and structure and the sizes and proportions of certain features, like how big or small your nose is, how long your eyelashes are, how big your eyes are. And then it tells you whether or not the app thinks you're pretty and gives you a score, a beauty or a pretty score. And now girls are sharing their scores with each other or posting them on social media. Some of the apps even compare your score to the scores of certain celebrities. And so it's just taking the problems that already existed with social media, these metrics of kind of constant comparison, and these artificial standards of beauty that were just being dumped into girls' feeds by these algorithms, you know, the entire universe of these kind of just artificially enhanced images of celebrities, influencers. Now you add to that AI apps that are literally giving a score, artificially quantifying a girl's beauty, and then incentivizing her to numerically compare that to her friends. I mean, this is only going to increase the scary trends we've seen in teen girls' mental health, like depression, anxiety, self-harm, suicide. I don't think parents realize, but the latest CDC study found 1 in 3 high school-aged girls in the United States seriously considered taking her own life last year. That's 1 in 3 high school girls. We have never seen this before in our country. And so this is something parents must pay attention to. And I would just encourage you again, this is why I urge parents to really opt out of the smartphone, because the sad thing is, even if you as a parent set the strictest content restrictions on a smartphone to say, only show my child apps that are rated as appropriate for a 4-year-old and up, these AI beauty apps, I went and looked them up in the App Store myself, are rated 4+. That means they have been rated by the apps themselves as safe for a 4-year-old and up. So any child can access these apps, and it makes those content restrictions just completely meaningless. So really, parents, it's so difficult to see into everything your kids could be accessing or downloading on a smartphone. I would just encourage you to opt out entirely.
So, in addition to just the amazing time wasted by doing these, let's talk a little bit about the physical effects of this. And you've talked about oxytocin and how your oxytocin levels are affected by not being outside. And exactly how does that work?
Yeah, so these apps and devices are feeding children dopamine, which is a neurotransmitter that gives you a burst of pleasure in your brain that makes you feel good. And it actually incentivizes you to do that activity again, because the dopamine doesn't produce lasting satisfaction or fulfillment. It immediately then your brain kind of plunges into a dopamine deficit, and it makes you want to do that thing again. So kids are getting lots of dopamine through these apps and these social interactions online, but what they're not getting is oxytocin, which is another critical hormone, another happiness hormone, makes us feel good, but it's actually only released through eye contact and physical touch. And what that hormone does is creates bonds of deep trust, of really strong friendship. And so it's what bonds a mother with her baby, it bonds husband and wife, it bonds friends. And kids are in an oxytocin desert online. They are not getting oxytocin through these online interactions. And so much of their life has now moved online. They're not hanging out with friends in real life. They're interacting over social media. And so they are more connected than ever. Yet we have this loneliness epidemic because they don't actually have deep friendships. The friendships are built on very shallow connections, again, based on their likes or their followers online. And so we are really depriving our children of the ability to develop real meaningful friendships in the real world.
So do you find that people think that your view is extreme, or are you seeing that people understand, especially in light that these tragedies that keep happening in our country involving shootings, the one common theme seems to be that the perpetrators are often addicted to their computers and to
Yes.
dark parts of the web. And I'm just wondering if people are sort of coming around and saying, your idea is sane. It's not just extreme.
Yes, I do think people are coming around. I think it would have been seen probably as more extreme 3 or even 5 years ago. But now, just in the wake of so much evidence, you mentioned Jonathan Haidt's The Anxious Generation, people see for themselves the changes in the kids these days, that they're so just isolated and on their screens, and they're so anxious all the time, and they're not doing things in the real world, and they're not very independent or confident to take on real life situations or to problem solve and navigate the world that they will need to navigate as an adult. So I think people are observing this firsthand in their lives. We're seeing the data increasingly come out through Senate hearings or through reporting in the news on even internal studies uncovered from these social media platforms, knowing they were harming young users. So I do think the mountain of evidence that is now built up is convincing parents, okay, maybe a total opt-out is necessary. And you mentioned like some of these recent acts of political violence or school shootings, these just horrible tragedies. A common thread through the perpetrators of these violent acts was that they shared a very similar online footprint, maybe pornography addiction or being involved in certain transgressive sexual communities online, like the trans community. In the case of the Charlie Kirk shooting, also this community called the furry community, which are these anthropomorphized, sexualized animals. And so there's all these sorts of kind of things in common, heavy online gaming. And so I'm not saying that every social media user or online gamer is going to go on to commit violent acts, but I think we have to recognize it is malformative for all of us. It does something to the human soul and the human mind that is not good for us. It is not natural. And I think it desensitizes people to the real world, for some to the point that they do commit such a horrendous act of violence, because we are really kind of dehumanizing and desensitizing through this constant online interaction, and we're not forming those deep bonds in real life. And so I hope this is kind of a wake-up call for parents. And I will say, even with my book coming out and conversations I've had with parents, more and more parents are doing this. And they say, thank you so much for this book. I've been thinking this myself for years, but I kind of didn't really have the courage to do it. And it was through hearing that no, families are doing this. You can do this too, was I think really empowering for parents. So, you know, it's not just my book. There's growing movements, smartphone-free childhood started in the UK, is now also in the US, just parents banding together saying, you know what, the best thing we can do for our kids is to opt out. Let's all opt out, delay smartphones together. So I'm encouraged. I think it's a growing movement, and I hope it continues to grow so that we can really reclaim American childhood for our kids.
Yeah, I've heard landlines are coming back, and that's one of your solutions in your book, because yep. people do have to communicate and make plans sure. to pick people up for games or have you know, kids over. Let me ask you this. Do you think that boys and girls fundamentally use social media differently, and that it affects them differently? Or are you kind of just lumping it all in that it's just bad and it rewires your brain?
Yes, I do think, there are certain commonalities that affect everybody's brain. Just the addictive design, I think, impacts boys and impacts girls. I think girls are more affected by the social dynamics of social media, the kind of constant social comparison. And so we see trends more in girls towards this anxiety or towards self-harm, because of these kinds of just dark kind of holes they get into of this comparison to all these artificial standards of beauty. I think for boys, we see bigger issues with online gaming. And in fact, a lot of them are actually socializing through the online games. A lot of these online gaming platforms have kind of chat, message features, follow friends, that type of thing. And so I think boys are more drawn into that, and that has its own problems. I mean, and fundamentally on a brain level, it really spikes their adrenaline and cortisol without having any physical release for it. So they're playing these intensive games, and then they're not expending that in a physical activity or exercise. And so it can make boys feel really revved up, really hyper. And so it can mimic itself as ADHD or even like autism symptoms, this kind of emotional dysregulation, kind of poor ability to focus, diminished attention spans, a lot more externalizing behavior. A lot of moms have said their son just seemed angry and moody and just very agitated. And a lot of that is coming from the games. And so I think it just affects the boys and the girls differently. Girls then tend to get more anxious and manifest it that way. And I think the boys can get more agitated and irritated and angry and kind of externalize in different ways. And then I think, but common in both of them is just kind of increased rates of depression, increased rates in suicidality. And I think it's just because there is a sense of kind of hopelessness that this generation is feeling, because the dopamine, it makes you feel good when you're on it, but then it just crashes. And so, you know, they get dopamine from the gaming, they get dopamine from the social media, and it just over time desensitizes them to pleasures in the real world. So real life just feels really mundane, really boring, and kind of pointless. And so their life becomes this online world where there are not adults to look out for them, and where they're not getting those bonds of friendship, the things that we need to flourish as humans, other human relationships. So those are the trends that I kind of see, some commonalities and then differences between boys and girls.
We have just a little bit of time left. If people think abstinence from social media for my kids seems overwhelming, can you give us two quick steps for people to get there if they can't just cut off right away?
Yeah, I would just say, you know, try out a detox for just a shorter period of time. Maybe you're not convinced that your child could give this up permanently, but I've had a lot of parents say they've had success doing a week-long kind of digital detox. Like, we're not going to do social media or smartphones this week. If you can, even doing 30 days, you will see bigger changes in terms of their brains kind of recalibrating, that dopamine returning to a normal homeostasis. That you can even just set a month aside and try to do this as a family for 30 days. And what a lot of parents said is just having that commitment, we can do this for 30 days, kind of explaining why to the kids, they then were able to see the results for themselves, both the parents and the kids. And it actually made it possible to envision doing that long term. I will also say, No, I was just going to say, if you can also do one thing, I would just really say, try to just take away the smartphone and opt for an alternative phone. Because even if you were allowed them to continue to have a social media account on a computer, it is not the same. It's not as addictive. It's not as immersive and constant as having it on the phone. I view the smartphone as the main source of the problems, especially because there's other dangerous AI apps that you might not even know about. So my encouragement would be to start with the smartphone if you can, and just transition them to an alternative phone that still lets them have tools or texting or calling, but no internet, no social media, you know, no online gaming. And there's many options now available for teens, like the Gab phone, Bark phone, Pinwheel phone, they can use to stay in touch with people, but not have addictive elements to them.
Those are great pieces of advice. And I hope that we can all look at our usage and find more ways to be with other people in real life. To learn more about Claire Morrell and the movement to reclaim technology for the family, please visit afutureforthefamily.org and catch her work at eppc.org. And her book is available at amazon.com and bookstores nationwide. Claire, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. Yes. And just last thing, visit thetechexit.com. I have more resources to accompany the book available for parents there, and you can find places to order the book as well.
Fantastic. To learn more about the Catholic Association, visit us at catholicassociation.org and follow us on social media to learn everything we do.
Welcome to Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Ashley McGuire, and I'm joined by our wonderful TCA chaplain, Monsignor Roger Landry. And well, we only have a few minutes left, but I don't want our time to end without also talking about one of my favorite saints, Saint Therese of Lisieux, whose feast day is on October 1st. She's known colloquially as the Little Flower. Why?
Because she said that we don't all have to be a rose in God's garden. We know that the roses please God and what a great smell that they give off. But she said we can be a petite fleur, we can be a little flower. And if the gardener has planted us, we bring him joy too. There's a purpose that not every flower in the garden is a rose. Some are tulips, some are carnations, some are sunflowers, you name it. She was totally content to remain a little flower rather than a great rose, provided that that's what God wanted of her. And so she taught us all her little way to holiness, that we don't have to be one of these great saints written in the books, the ones who do heroic feats or through whom God works tremendous miracles of healing or exorcism. But we can please God along the way of trust and love. As a little child, entrusting ourselves to God with trust, just like a little kid does to loving parents, and then a way of love that he has filled us with love and we want to love others. She said that the way to holiness is not climbing up a high mountain. It's actually going down into the valley of humility where God meets us and then lifts us up. She's one of the great saints of all time. She's worked various stupendous miracles in my own life. I'm very happy that I share a great devotion with you. But the one thing I want to emphasize about Saint Therese, beyond what we've said, is she's a co-patroness of the missions of the church. In October, we start World Mission Month, which culminates on October 19th this year, World Mission Sunday. Why is Saint Therese, who never left her Carmel in Northwest France, a co-patron with Saint Francis Xavier of the mission? And the clear reason is because the mission of the church always begins with prayer. Jesus told us to pray to the harvest master for laborers for his harvest. And Saint Therese and her Carmel, with all her other Carmelites, were praying for the mission of the church. She adopted two young missionaries as her spiritual brothers and really prayed for them and offered her sufferings for them and for the fruitfulness of their work. And so, for those of us who have a devotion to Saint Therese, it's important that we share her great love and care for the missions and join her, who continues to pray in heaven, for Christ to be known to everybody all over the face of the earth. That's how we start the month of October.
Well, they're words that we take to heart, especially in light of a lot of really hard, difficult recent events that reflecting on love and prayer are truly the little but the great way. So we thank you,
And they
Monsignor.
are the most powerful thing we do.
Well, thank you, Monsignor. Thank you for joining us today.
Great to be with you once again, Ashley. Happy World Mission Month.
You too.
We'd like to take a moment to thank all of our loyal listeners who tune in each week to Conversations with Consequences. As you all know, the Catholic Association is everywhere. We were on TV to cover the conclave and the election of the new pope. We're in print, we're online, and we're on social media. We've just launched a new Substack to expand our media presence and offer more great content from a Catholic perspective. We're on X, and now we're on Substack for Catholic Conversations with TCA, where we're featuring exciting new interviews, commentaries, videos, and more, featuring our four fellows, Ashley McGuire, Mary Fiorito, Lee Sneed, and Betsy Fentress. And we'll be having guest columnists each week as well. Just recently, Ashley shared some little-known facts about Saint Carlo Acutis. Lee Sneed writes about her forthcoming book on infertility, titled Infertile But Fruitful, and explains why she decided to write the book. So many people had responded to her columns and podcasts on her journey toward becoming an adoptive mother that she felt called to write a full-length book about it. In Lessons from the Turnaway Study, Mary Fiorito writes about mothers who wanted to abort their children initially, but were turned away for various reasons and had a very different take on their initial decision as years passed. And Betsy Fentress writes on hospitality and the will to live about a friend's father and a family friend with no relatives who were brought back to life by food, attention, and love. We hope you'll subscribe to our Substack. It's free. You'll find it at catholicassociation.substack.com. And we'd love for you to join us in our continuing Catholic conversations.